Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Humans Vexus Manchester with me, Clint Boone. This series is sponsored by our friends at Safer Roads GM, helping us to keep ourselves and each other safe on the road to Manchester. This week, I'm joined by founder member of legendary dance outfit 808 State, Mr. Graham Massey. Graham describes growing up in Levenshulme and the importance of community.
Back then, you were just thrown out of the house. You were largely brought up by the people around you, which was a community, and I really appreciated that.
And he talks about his musical influences.
As Stevie Wonder entered that sort of Inner Visions talking book kind of period, you know, that's kind of where I came in. You know, I thought those albums just sounded amazing, you know, for on my young ears.
Gives a great pleasure to welcome to Humans Vexus Manchester a chap who's recognised mainly for his creation just over 30 years ago of one of the most influential dance music acts of modern times. His name's Graham Massey, and that dance act, just one of the many beautiful things he's created, is 808 State. Graham Massey, how are you, brother?
Yeah, I'm good, yeah.
Nice to
see
you.
Thanks for having us in.
Hey, you're welcome, man. Yeah. You're looking good.
About my long life.
We are going to be talking about your long life. We're going to be talking a lot about 808 State and some of the other amazing projects that you've done over the years. And we'll be talking about your new music as well, which is incredible. But first of all, Graham, what I'd like to do with every guest on Humans Vexus Manchester is go right back to the beginning and talk about when and where you were born, Graham Massey. When and where?
I was born in August 1960. It's my birthday in 2 days, in fact.
Is it?
Yeah, I'll be 59.
Right, you having a party?
No, I'm going to have that when I'm 60.
Right.
but yeah, I was born in Levenshulme. Levenshulme was where I was brought up, which is now all kind of cool and trendy, isn't it, Levenshulme? Yeah. But back in the 60s, it was largely sort of an Irish sort of sector of Manchester.
Yeah.
Well, that's generalising, but that was my kind of experience of it.
Were you born at home or hospital?
I was born in a nursing home. I was the posh one of my three other brothers. You know, I've got three brothers, and there's four of us. And for some reason, I was born in some private nursing home in Burnage.
Burnage. Are you the eldest then, Graham?
No, I'm number three of four.
You can't remember which.
Yeah, so I've got two older ones and a younger one by, who was, there was a big gap after me.
Right,
and then he's the the little one.
And what do you remember about your childhood? Is it nice memories?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, growing up in Levenshulme back then, you were just thrown out of the house, you know, when at daybreak and brought in when the street lamps came on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was the code to come back in. And even then, you didn't come back in. It was like largely outdoor in a big gang of kids. Everyone had brothers, you know. It was a real nice sort of set of, like a sort of, it was like the double deckers, really.
It's a different world, I mean, because I grew up in Oldham, same age as you, pretty much, and grew up in Oldham. And it's like you say, you just go and play out all day, and you travel on your bikes for miles, and have adventures and summer holidays. We're saying this when Steve Hodge came, and he was one of our early guests on the podcast. You'd go out when the summer holiday starts. It starts in June or whatever. I don't know. You'd go out on your bike and you won't come back till September the 3rd.
Yeah.
You know, the day before it was the time to go back to
school.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a great sense of freedom and being unsupervised, really, you know.
Yeah.
And not to say my parents weren't parental, but, you know, you were largely brought up by the people around you, which was a community, and I really appreciated that.
Mm.
And certainly when bringing, you know, my own son up, you know, I wanted him to have a taste of that, you know. I was worried that that wouldn't happen for this generation that's happening now.
Yeah.
And took, some, you know, some concern over making sure that did happen, you know. So
I think that gang thing that we had when we were kids, people like me and you have found that in our adulthood by being in bands and being around musicians. That's the same sort of thing, isn't it? We can't play out on the streets anymore because we'll get kidnapped and we'll start a band. That should keep us out of trouble.
Yeah, but music in that community was really important as well, you know.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of music trickling down from the older brothers. Certainly in my case, my brother went to uni, went to Oxford Uni, actually. It was a clever chap, which, you know, no peer pressure there, but but he started bringing the prog in once he started going to university, and you know, you'd like things like Yes albums and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
And did you get
like
it?
That.
Did you get it at the time or not?
I was really interested in it, and you know, mainly from the album covers and things like that. You know, that world of fantasy album covers really played a part.
Yeah.
And I guess I was quite into art at school and doing sort of weird pictures. And amongst my peers, you know, everyone was going like, oh, you know, Mass is a bit weird, you know, from an early age, you know, from about nine or something.
You're
I got
still saying it about you now, aren't
yeah,
you?
No, I kind of got labelled as being, you know, slightly, you know, artistic or whatever, you know.
So was that the first music that interested you, your brother's prog rock collection, or was there other stuff going on, like on the radio?
Some of the first things I bought was 10cc on 7-inch, like Rubber Bullets was one of my first ones. And Kevin Godley actually used to park his car outside Levenshulme Library, and we used to mind it for him. He won't remember, but
that's a great story.
Can we mind your car, mister? It was a Jensen Interceptor.
Oh, do you remember that? They're brilliant cars then, weren't they?
So he was like a pop star amongst us.
Yeah.
So we were supporting him. And then Stevie Wonder, 7 inches, you know, as Stevie Wonder entered that sort of Inner Visions talking book kind of period, you know, that's kind of where I came in. You know, I thought those albums just sounded amazing, you know, for on my young ears, you know.
Another thing that probably, I'm guessing you were mesmerised by this as much as I was and a million other kids, the TV shows in that era, like the mid to late 60s, early 70s, you had these amazing theme tunes, like one of my favourite pieces ever, Fireball XL5, the theme tune. And I've sort of ripped that many a time with the In Spirals and Clint Boone Experience songs. But
Barry Gray,
Joe 90, Doctor Who.
Well, yeah.
The first time you heard the Doctor Who theme tune and saw that sequence, that opening sequence, closing sequence, did that hit you?
That definitely hit me, yeah. It was, you know, the visuals and the music together were, you know, so futuristic.
It was like acid, but we didn't know what acid was.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And the other really important one for me was the ending titles of UFO, which was Barry Gray.
Yeah.
And actually, in years later, when they've been re-releasing Barry Gray, in fact, Barry Gray was from somewhere like Blackburn, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, he went to the RNCM and everything, didn't he?
Did he?
Yeah, when it was just the College of Music in Manchester. Sorry, I digress.
Yeah.
But the ending theme music to UFO was actually a Hoover commercial from 1963. So that makes it even more futuristic.
Brilliant.
It was this atonal kind of like falling music. And I remember things like 2001 A Space Odyssey. My older brother had the soundtrack to that, and that thing where the pillar appears, Luxa Turner by, I think it's Ligeti or something. I remember that being the scariest music ever, and just sort of returning to it all the time to see if I was still scared by it. And growing up in the 60s, some of my earliest memories were seeing rockets go off on the TV, you know. Very little daytime TV back then, where if there was a rocket launch, you know, that you'd watch that, or they'd bring out the big telly at school.
I was having this conversation the other day with somebody about how big the space race was, as we called it, and it was like, where kids are glued to the telly now for X Factor and all that bollocks.
Yeah.
The space race was our X Factor, wasn't it, in a lot of ways, in terms of the thing that brought the families together to watch at night and you know, night after night after night for weeks on end until they came back, these fellas or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, how I remember the 60s is it was either the space race, which was really hopeful and futuristic, or it was the Vietnam War, and that was just really worrying, you know. And there was this sense of the Cold War back then as well, which was really worrying, you know. So there was, though we were like kind of free and sort of like, you know, quite a happy bunch of people, he always had this sort of threatening kind of Cold War vibe in the background that was just what you lived in. Yeah. And there was this duality to the 60s that was like, you know, part of it was just super hopeful. And I'm really glad I lived through a bit of the 60s, you know, because it was a tangible optimism about it.
At what point did you start playing instruments?
Probably when it was about 14 or something. I was really, when we were talking about space race, I was really into astronomy. Me and my best mate next door, Greg, we both had matching reflector telescopes.
Geek alert.
Yeah, in the back garden, you know. And I swapped mine for an electric guitar at Peter's Swap Shop in Levenhulme around about when it was about 13, 14. And that's when I started making noise experiments.
Yeah, I say musical instruments because you are a multi-instrumentalist, aren't you? You played pretty much everything, don't you?
Yeah, I'm a right dabbler. Yeah. I've never stuck to one instrument. I've always thought of music in terms of sound.
Yeah.
And, you know, not to be restricted by just that thing of learning an instrument. I think there was a little bit of rebellion going on at school when you got to choose an instrument. I really wanted to play the oboe and they wouldn't let me do it for some reason. That built something up in me. I could never fit in with music at school, you know.
That's ironic, isn't it? Because your most famous line of music of all time is pretty much an oboe sort of riff, in it, and
I got my revenge.
Up your ass, teacher.
Yeah, and you know, even at school, we started like, you know, sort of rebellious music activity in the lunch hours. We had this thing called the Wonkavator, which was like a load of oil cans shoved in a cupboard that we used to make sort of tribal music on, you know, throughout the lunchtime. And that's where I met a guy called Colin Seddon, who later introduced us to being in a band. He had a band in Burnage, and we started to play space rock.
Wow.
In about 1977.
I was going to say, because we're getting around the time punk rock arrived here, aren't we? So how did punk affect you? I know you got, right, you were into the prog already, and you know, subsequently made a lot of music that was art rock or whatever.
We were going to gigs quite early. Like, gigs were really cheap. They were like 50p, 75p if you went to the Free Trade Hall or something like that. And I remember I was outside the Palace Theatre going to see a group called Supercharge when two of my friends came past, and they were like, oh, we're off to the Free Trade Hall to see the Sex Pistols. And they had a little flyer about it. And it was then like, he said, oh, you should come to this. It's like, oh, no, I bought a ticket. It's like 75p, you know. And, you know, that was a distinct moment where two of my friends actually were at that first thing, and you know, so, and then started collecting all the newspaper clippings about it, and we were very aware of it being something that was happening in our town, you know. It wasn't just a national thing, it was like quite a colloquial thing to us.
Yeah.
And going to early punk gigs, you know, there's quite a mixture of tribes at a punk gig in Manchester. There's still all the long hair RAF greatcoat people at punk gigs, you know.
It was amazing. I was there, and it was a lot of guys in flares, you know, at punk gigs.
Yeah.
Guys in flares, like I say, long, a lot of that smell of musk oil, petunia oil, whatever they call
it. Yeah, patchouli oil.
It was
oil,
all
yeah.
that patchouli. Yeah, just proper. The hippies was very much part of the punks, weren't they?
They were intrinsically
linked, really. And also, these hippies were the ones that were letting us put these punk bands on in these gigs, weren't they? They were sympathetic to the cause, really.
So, like, the first record I ever appeared on or put out was a thing by a group. We had a group called Danny and the Dressmakers. Yeah. And we were, you know, almost like a tongue-in-cheek punk group. It was just like we just get in the cellar and make it, fill a C90 full of, you know, vapid noise, you know. It was just a noise band, and you always played the instrument that you could play the least, you know. And, you know, quite often ended up on drums because I was useless at that, and that was important to play badly, you know.
And at this point, you'd be like 17, 18, you know. Did you have a job as well at this point? Were you a postman or something?
No, I didn't have a job for years because, right. That was sort of my, Thatcher's Britain. It took me about 10 years to get a job. I was on the dole for about 10 years.
Right.
And then, I became a postman.
And was it either Sean Ryder's postman?
Yeah, no. he was probably at the main sorting office.
Out in Levenger. I knew he was a postman because he was Hookie's postman, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But I thought you were somebody's postman.
I was the Gallagher's postman.
That's the fella.
in Burnage, yeah.
That sounds like a line from a great song. I was the Gallagher's postman.
Yeah, I think there was some incident where I delivered the gyro to the wrong house and was in trouble for a
while. Do the Gallaghers remember that?
He did remember that when I first started working with the Inspirals with you. Yeah, right. I did your first session on Joe, wasn't it?
Yeah, we'll come to that in a minute. Yeah, that's a really nice chapter in the nice little crossover, and it's pretty much where me and you first met.
Yeah.
Before that, let's talk about Biting Tongues. You had a band, Biting Tongues. I think the word seminal is what you used to describe a band that were magnificent, and they made beautiful music. They were quite inspiring on the Manchester music scene. It was before Madchester.
Yeah.
You've got the band back together in recent years, haven't you? But Biting Tongues, describe that to us.
Well, Biting Tongues, we were all rehearsing in this cellar, and we split into two groups after our first group. One became Crispy Ambulance, who were on Thatcher Records, infamous group. And the other one became Biting Tongues, also ended up on Thatcher Records. But originally we were put out by New Hormones Records, who did the Buzzcocks.
Yeah.
But what we were we got together to do a live soundtrack to a film at the Factory Club, which was the PSV club in Hume.
Yeah.
And under the encouragement of Tony Wilson, who set up the Factory to be like an Andy Warhol happening art scene kind of club, you know, that's what he had in his mind. So some of the members of the band were amateur filmmakers, so that's how we got together. We literally met on stage to do this.
But the level soundtrack. Of musicianship was stunning for somebody like me at that
Yeah,
point.
there was just a sort of chemistry with that band where everyone had worked out some individuality already. And the sum of the parts was just kind of, you couldn't really describe the music other than later on we got grouped in with groups like A Certain Ratio and 23 Skidoo into post-punk. But no one called it post-punk at the time. They called it New Wave, I guess. And everyone knew that everyone had cut up the rule book.
Yeah.
But most of all, it was just an attitude of do or die. You know, the Manchester music scene back then was very competitive. There was a thing called the Manchester Music
Collective.
Musicians Collective,
yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Where gigs were dished out on a monthly basis. We all met in a pub and decided what the game plan was. And it included bands like The Fall and Joy Division and things like Vibrant Thigh, Crispy Ambulance. And these gigs were dished out, and it was a matter of honour to be the best band in the universe back then. You know, there was a sense of, like, it's not going to get out of Manchester. So the people you were competing against were right there, then. You know, it was a really colloquial and small-minded kind of thing to it. You know, no one had a hope of transcending your colloquialism, really. So it was amazing when somebody like Joy Division did, you know.
Yeah. What point did Biting Tongues sort of, or that part of your life, morph into the next chapter, which would be the 8-to-8 state thing? Did you see the thing happening? Did you see the Hacienda thing start to come alive and the scene before 8-to-8, or did you already have 8-to-8 in position?
As with most bands, you know, a lot of bands just dissolve into other bands. You know, there's just the natural, people just grow up in different ways. Our band fell apart a few times. One of the times was when half our band was a band called Yago.
Yago were brilliant.
Yeah, with Paddy Steer and Phil Kirby.
Yeah.
And they got signed to London Records, and that's when Biting Tongues kind of fell apart a bit.
Right.
But we fell apart slowly and introduced drum machines and synthesizers. And I was starting to do a sound engineering course at SSR, which was really new and embryonic, over on Tariff Street in the Northern Quarter. And so with the advent of computers, being able to support writing music.
MIDI.
Yeah, it was a revelation to me because then I could really get my ideas down with computers.
Yeah.
Whereas before, you used to have to get in a room, learn to play it, make sure everyone remembered it for the next time.
Well, you'd have to find people to come and play the other parts, wouldn't you?
But yeah.
Because I was tinkering about in my bedroom with instruments and things I was making noise with from probably 1981, 82.
Yeah.
And then through into 84. I think probably 84 was when I first became aware of this MIDI thing that was starting to happen.
Yeah.
And for bedroom musicians, in inverted commas, like us, it was just a revelation, wasn't it?
Because you could freeze time.
Absolutely.
And think about things. You know, you didn't have to think totally in the moment all the time. You could freeze something and go like, oh, what if I try this? No, yeah. I could try that. You know, you could start putting colour palettes together. And I found it totally liberating to be able to think about music in a slower way and less spontaneous. But having said that, you got to understand that we were very versed in being spontaneous. We were very literate in imagination. So when you bring all that stuff to computers, you end up with something as weird as 808 State was at the beginning.
It's just a real organic coming together of everything, isn't it? Like the music was coming in from Chicago and Detroit.
Yeah.
The fact that we had this huge nightclub that was available. It wasn't busy at that point, was it?
Early? No.
And then the drugs were coming in. And your mindset, obviously, coming from that hippie prog background where anything goes and we can try. And the punk thing had liberated
us. Yeah, it was about imagination. So all the people I knew in Manchester who were involved in house music were coming more from the... There was these record shops like Spinning in Manchester. There was a traditionalism in dance music. I mean, we used to play... Some of the first gigs we used to play with 808 State were like soul weekenders. And, you know, there was a very biased audience there that weren't open to new things. It was all about the tradition, and it was all about, you know, DJs being very specific about where the sources of that music came from. So to go in there with new music, it was repelled by that scene, you know.
And it was a new music that sounded a bit wonkier than anything we'd had before.
Yeah, it almost made us want to do it more wonky, this being surrounded by traditionalists.
The way that the Inspirals got linked to me, you guys, was we had a record deal with a company called Playtime Records in Manchester. That came to an end. We were advised by Martin Price, who was part of 808 State at the time. Martin Price had started a label called Creed. He had Eastern Bloc Records. And he said, look, set your own label up. And we were like, we don't know what to do. He said, I'll help you with it. So he set up our distribution and everything. That's where Cow Records was born. One of the first things we did was to get in the studio with you to record Jaw, the single Jaw. And it was the first time, to me, in my mind, that a collaboration was happening between a guitar band and a dance outfit. You produced it. You put that drum machine sort of vibe to it.
Yeah.
And I've got really nice memories of that in Square One in Bury. You at the desk and us doing our best to play this garage music. Martin Price stood next to us saying, right, no, do that again, a bit tighter, do that, change that. But I remember him standing there, like, you know, helping us and making this really cool dance-inspired or dance.
Yeah, he was very much a person that was obsessed by music. He was like had an encyclopedic knowledge of music.
Yeah.
And every time we were in the studio, he always had about, you know, four bags of records with him, and he was always like keen to sort of put stuff on and go like more like this, more like that. You know, it's kind of it was almost like bursting out of him the amount of direction he wanted to put into music.
The passion and enthusiasm.
But often that was kind of sort of channeled through my one finger keyboard playing, you know, it was all squeezed in there kind of thing. And then, of course, Gerald was in the group early on as well, you know.
A guy called Gerald.
And he'd already got his game together, you know, he'd already got his, you know, his techniques and things like that. And he wasn't the easiest of collaborators, you know, kind of thing, because he was like, he was certain about what he was doing kind of thing, you know. So again, it was a kind of community it was like a community project, really.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, going back to Martin Price, another thing that I want to say about him, and it's relevant to what else was happening in the city at the time. Before that 1988, 89 sort of era, blokes, young lads, didn't dance on their own.
Yeah.
If you went out to a club or a bar or a pub, you'd dance either with your girlfriend or some girls, or you'd dance with your mates.
Yeah.
But blokes didn't dance on their own, as I saw it, until that era. That's when it was all right to go to the Hacienda on your own, being a corner, just raving, or stand with some other guys raving. But in Price, I remember him being in the studio just dancing on his own all the time, just going for it, and not worried about us looking like, what are you fucking doing?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's like it became all right for blokes to dance on their own in that. Yeah. That
well, it was
era.
Interesting that those, when we started out, you know, a lot of the people who were involved were very much part of that, you know, bit of lino in the middle of Market Street breakdancing thing, you know, they'd all come from electro and hip hop, and that was an established dance culture. In fact, like years later, I think it was Jason Orange was part of what they had a dance crew that was very credible street dance crew.
Yeah, I can't remember the name, but
They all knew each other from that. And later on, Take That would come to 808 at the G-Mex and everything because of the. There was this common street culture of electro that a lot of it had sprang from. You know? So dancing was prevalent in that. But I know the nightclub scene in Manchester, when you used to go to, like, I don't know if you ever went to Rotters.
Oh, yeah.
Where you had to wear a tie.
I preferred Rafters in the basement.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of nightclubs in Manchester, there was a dress code, wasn't there? Yeah. And, you know, certainly a sort of code of... a sexual code, as it were, you know.
And the DJs would be introducing every song and back announcing every song.
And it's
a different world, wasn't it?
It's definitely a different world. And the Hacienda started to break that down. Though we always saw the Hacienda as being a bit sort of face and ID as well. You know, it was slightly pretentious for years, you know, something that didn't fit with a lot of people.
Yeah,
I know, like, the younger lads in 808 would never go there because... it had this sort of, like, you know, London-centric kind of view of the world. You know, that broke down in 88, and it always broke down on a Friday with that particular night that they had on a Friday, because that was much more related to nightclubs like Legends in Manchester and, you know, some of the stuff that was coming out of Moss Side, who are, you know, it's much more of a black night. The Friday night, and that's the night that kind of broke the acid house stuff, and then the other nights got polluted by it.
Yeah. Have you got memories of recording that first album, the new build, the first 808 album?
Oh yeah, we did that in a weekend. Yeah, it was a real, you know, studio time was so rare, expensive, and you really had to have your game together. You know, I remember getting. A reel of tape out of the skips at the BBC. We used to do a program called Meltdown. We used to go, and there was like, "Have you got a tape?" You know, we're like, "Oh, you could have this. It's in the bin," kind of thing. And it was a newsreel tape with an edit every 4 inches. It had an edit, you know, because they've been using it for news footage. So when I took that to get mastered, the mastering engineer just fell on the floor laughing, going like, "What have you done with this?" You know, it's like it's just shredded already. You know. And, you know, we just begged, stealed and borrowed time. You know, I used to be on that course at SSR and be the caretaker. So I got to look after it overnight, which, of course, was like free studio time. You know,
brilliant.
Used to sneak everyone in the middle of the night. And we only ever did nighttime sessions. And then Gerald went to work at McDonald's in the morning. That's when the session was over.
Wow, you know? I remember that. Yeah. And that album was groundbreaking, but you probably didn't realise that at the time, did you? What?
I think the defining thing about that album is its density.
Right.
And its complex sort of cross rhythms. It sounds like a version or, you know, it's very polyrhythmic and very polytonal. There's a lot of, it'd be interesting to go back and listen to what kind of cassettes we were listening to back then, because it wasn't just house music we were listening to, you know, there was a lot of other things that informed that
jazz,
music.
You've always had jazz, like Biting Tongues, there was a lot of jazz.
Totally. I mean, if you're interested in music, you'll end up in them places, won't you? You know, you'll end up on Miles Davis, in Miles Davis land, and, you know, because it's just going to come at you.
I've spent 40 years... resisting jazz and saying it's not for me and I don't get it. I've just recently embraced it in the last couple of years, really embraced it. Mainly because I've got a decent sound system, and as a musician I appreciate what's going on in there, and I appreciate the fact that a lot of these performances are live performances straight to stereo or even mono in some cases. So
jazz is such a clumsy word in a way, you know, it has so much baggage for different people, you know. It's like We need a better word.
It needs
for
retagging,
you know?
On it. Yeah. So we eventually come round to Pacific State, which was suddenly you had a hit record, you were doing Top of the Pops and all that business.
Yeah.
And how was that point of your life? Did you long to be a pop star as a kid? Like what?
No, I never really thought of that would happen, you know. Just the music we were making wasn't...
Yeah, you didn't know, yeah.
It would never hit the mainstream.
You were never thinking of Top of the Pops,
No, we were always thinking John Peel.
Right.
Like, John Peel is a place where we felt comfortable, and yeah. Somebody actually went to the John Peel archives and pulled out everything that he ever played of mine on John Peel. There's an amazing selection of different stuff that he played, you know.
And stuff after 808 as well,
Before and after, yeah.
Because you did loads after, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, that's kind of what was always the ambition, really. It's just get it on Peel, yeah. You know, because then you would, the whole country was listening, you know. Yeah.
And he was so powerful back then. It was just, it's hard to explain today how powerful he was in terms of the influence he had on that generation of people.
Yeah, imagine if he wasn't there, there would be a whole set of music that just didn't get anywhere.
We wouldn't be here doing this, would we?
No. So, you know, in order for the mainstream to collapse, it took something like rave. You know, the rave movement was so powerful in terms of a cultural event, and no one was an expert on rave music. And through that gap in the fence, we just ran across the playing field with all this nonsense music that we had, you know. And none of our hits, and we had, you know, numerous appearances on Top of the Pops, numerous entries into the British charts with the weirdest of music, you know. And I think that will always be my proudest achievement.
Yeah, it's quite achievement.
Is to take the most ambitious kind of music into the pop charts, you know. I think it changed a lot of people's perspectives on music and widened things. And that's what I've always wanted to do.
And in the process, you became a big cornerstone in what became known as EDM, electronic dance music.
So yeah.
You were one of the main contributors to that, as is Kraftwerk, who we'll talk about in a minute, because you did a gig with them recently, didn't you?
Yeah.
Let me just go back to, you mentioned Anthony Wilson. I'm assuming you always had a decent relationship with him.
Yeah, I mean, it was never a close relationship, but, you know, we'd run into each other all the time. You know, Summer Biting Tongues, we rehearsed in Didsbury, and Howard from Biting Tongues, he was making films, and Tony wanted to make a video company. He had a video editing suite in his basement and formed this company called Factory Icon to do VHS videos. And we ended up sort of copying tapes for him and getting involved in that. We made a film called Fever House in the early 80s. And Tony bankrolled that once we'd ran out of money on it. We got some Northwest Arts money to make this black and white film. And he got he was like, oh, that'll be great to launch my video thing. So that's how we first got involved with Factory. And we did a soundtrack album called Fever House, which is a very strange record.
I remember the film. I've got some of the VHS tapes. I think the Perverted by Language by The Fall was on there.
Yeah, it's interesting to go back over the Icon stuff, because it had art films, you know, concerts of New Order, concerts of the Fall promo videos, you know. It's quite a collection, eclectic collection of, if you wanted to know what the mid-80s were about.
Yeah, yeah. The Inspiral Carpets gig at the Hacienda, the first one we ever did, that was filmed by Icon, and it never came out, and I just often wonder where the films are, because it's a full professional shoot.
We did a gig with Nico and John Cooper Clarke at the Library Theatre, and they filmed that, and I wish to God I could find that.
Right. Talk about Anthony Wilson, you must have felt his spirit more than ever in recent months, because you've been working in the actual, on the new album, you've been recording it in the actual room. Do they call it not an edit suite,
the transmission suite? It's called. Yeah, it's where all the TVs, there's a wall of 80 TVs. It's where they used to sort of channel all the programs through, you know.
Yeah,
and you're channelling things from like, you know, Yorkshire TV. It's like the ITV network used to come through it.
Nerve Centre. But the Granada TV building in Manchester, it's still stood there until recently.
Yeah.
But a lot of the equipment was still in there, and it's fascinating. When you see, if you check out the video for Tokyo Talker, that's the 808 single, that's the actual room where I'm sure on many occasions Tony Wilson would have sat in that room and done his business.
when you see him doing that, like, you know, So It Goes, and he's got a bank of TVs behind him.
And all those keyboards in that video, were they all in the room in case you needed them for tracks, or were they there for props?
They were all in the room because my wife insisted that I take them out of the house. That's why they were all in the room.
It's an amazing scene, though, isn't it? And so we've got the first new album in 17 years coming out soon. It's Transmission Suite.
Yeah.
What was the inspiration, or what was your mindset when you were doing it? Was it nostalgia? Was it the future? Was it Manchester? How were you guided through that recording process?
The reason I was in the Transmission Suite is that I was given a project by MIF to do the opening of MIF 2017, was it? In Piccadilly Gardens with this huge yellow runway thing. It was a Jeremy Deller project called What Is the City, What the People? And I was in musical director for that. So I had to have a place to set up, and it need to be a room big enough to work with a number of people. So that's when I set up in Granada. And then at the end of that project, we just kept the studio on and started working on an album. And the reason we've not done one in so many years is that we've not had a bass for years. You know, we've continued sort of working as 808 State in terms of live stuff, and we've had our sort of bumpy ups and downs in the personnel and the way it was all clicking along. And it's not that we stopped making music or doing gigs. It's just that we needed a home. And very much like a band needs a nerve centre. It needs a centralising,
isn't that incredible,
9-to-5 kind of thing about it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But you can walk in and just press play and not without having to build it all. I remember going into one of your old places in...
Juicy House, it was.
And just seeing that, like, you had keyboards like nailed to the wall, literally.
Yeah.
So it was just like a mad professor's laboratory.
And it is a laboratory, and that's the way we work. It's not like you sit down with an acoustic guitar or, you know, you really have to have a lot, a huge musical palette with that. Well, it's at least the way I think, you know, it's kind of have everything available. And like you say, it's not just electronic music with 808 State. We throw all kinds of instruments at it and all kinds of textures, and bringing in, as with this one, we brought in a lot of other musicians into it. You know, once you get momentum as a musician, I think that's incredibly important to have that momentum. And that's why we've been so lucky in Manchester. Manchester music has a momentum. You know, there's a lot of people egging each other on. There's a lot of community in music in Manchester where you can go out and see something, and then you're inspired to respond to it.
It's always been like, hasn't it?
Yeah, no, that's like what I was saying about the early days with Biting Tongues. You know, there's this idea of like response to music around you that I think sometimes gets lost in the modern world. You know, this idea that, you know, community, basically. Yeah,
very supportive.
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk in depth too much about your other projects, but my favourite one, Sisters of Transistors.
Oh, yeah. one of my favourites, too.
It's brilliant. So it's basically four women playing retro vintage electric organs, Graham on drums.
Yeah.
Do check it out. It's on YouTube. It's all Sisters of Transistors. Great name, great band, great concept. I might steal that from you sometime.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Manchester, this beautiful city of ours.
Yeah.
You were born 11 June's, like, what, 2 or 3 miles outside the city centre, so you're very much a Mancunian. What do you love about the place?
I think it's really changing at the moment, you know, and it's making me reflect on the fact that, you know, Manchester was a fluid kind of... it's always had this student population that gives it a youthful buzz and makes the, you know, the nightlife particularly fluid. It's all, there's ideas there.
Yeah.
And... you know, it's not a static place. You know, like, you only have to go out and live, you know, say you lived in Spain or in Italy, and it's all like, there's a sort of, you know, age groups live really peacefully by each side. You know, it's like Manchester, there's always a little battle between the youth in Manchester and the other generations, you know, and I like to see that still happening. You know, I like to feel like they're pushing still. And, you know, I sometimes worry that they're not pushing enough these days, you know, but...
it's like the energy of, like, it's like a dog pulling at a lead, isn't it?
That's
that's a
yeah,
way
something's
of,
been tugged along.
Yeah, come,
or
on,
something.
Come on, come on, let's do it.
Come on, come on. But occasionally you'll come across these little pools of people going like, you know, it's dead like, yeah, don't understand that. Good, yeah. You know.
Are you aware of anything music wise that's happening in the city at the moment? It's very exciting. That's
I can't really put it into words, but yeah, I'm just sort of like, I mean, you've got 20-year-olds in the house, haven't you? You know what I mean? I just like the fact that they're coming in at 4 a.m. and something's going on. I mean, it's good that I don't know about it. You know what I mean? It wouldn't be right if I knew about it.
You're going to be your dad?
Yeah.
Music, that is.
No, but we have a healthy kind of, exchange about music.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, as a kid these days, you've got the entire history timeline of music to dip into, and they do.
And it's accessible in a touch of a button.
This idea of time travelling on a musical timeline is we sort of had a version of it when we were 20 or whatever, you know, but it wasn't nearly as filled in as it is, and it's not nearly as exploratory as, you know.
If I was to ask you, Graham, who are your favourite humans of Manchester, give us a few names.
Ooh, it's a toughie, that. Other than me mates, you know, we mentioned Paddy Steer before. I think he's as one of the people who's a lifer in music, you know, who goes through a journey in music that is very singular. I mean, we've done like huge big bands together where we were carting around at like a 14-piece like mini orchestra going around France and. Yeah. All the headaches that go with that. He's like gradually slimmed it down to a duo, and then he's slimmed it down to a solo act now. Brilliant. I don't know if you've seen his solo act recently, where he goes on stage as a sort of robot. He's got like, you know, this Egyptian costume and a sort of alien head, and he's playing instruments with his feet and his arms and everything. It's just totally amazing.
I can see why. It's like you're sort of connected at the hip. I mean, you've both got that inner and uncontrollable desire to make music, and you can see that when you read up on what you've done over the years, what you're doing now. It's like every time I talk to you, you've got a new project that you're working on. It's like, what did you do in Stockport the other week? What was that called that you were doing?
That was called the Beach Surgeon, and there was another one called Neo Tantric, which is with Sean Canty from Dem Dyke Stare and Andy Botell.
Yeah, but Paddy Steer, check him out, an amazing bass player, and Yargo, the band that we talked about earlier, Y-A-R-G-O, they should have been as big as Simple Red. They're nothing like Simple Red, but that sort of skill and talent.
Like Votel's a really good example of somebody that's put so much into music in Manchester. He's kind of like what he's done with that label Finders Keepers in terms of like eking out really valuable and lost nuggets of not just Manchester music, but let's just talk about Manchester music there, like stuff from the 70s that I wouldn't know about, shining a light on things like. I love the Manchester District Music Archive. Do you know this website?
It's incredible.
Yeah. And, the thing I love about that is that the timeline doesn't just stick to the polarised Madchester version of Manchester. And I really rail against that Madchester thing a lot of the time. I know it's been good to me and it's been good to you, but it's part of a much bigger marathon race that we shouldn't ignore that goes back centuries, really. Yeah. That makes this city a very important music city. You know, you go back to things like the Halley Orchestra, what a bunch of rebels they were back in the day, you know what I mean? In terms of playing, you know, all the music that wouldn't get played in London, you know, all the spiky new ideas got played up here, you know, first, you know, and it was like an orchestra that would just champion the outsider stuff, you know, and it's, I love all that.
It's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah. And in fact, the punk, you know, without Manchester, I think punk might not have been as monumental as it was in the UK, because we were one of the first cities that you could watch the Sex Pistols in.
Yeah, totally. You know, back to Granada, you know, their first gig being there. You know, it's funny under, you know, working in that room in Granada, because under my feet is like, I think it's called Studio 6 or something. It's the small studio where the Beatles first did their first TV stuff. You know, Joy Division did their first TV stuff. Yeah. So many firsts in this little, within cubic meters of where I was working. And just feel that history, you know. And then just that wider square mile of where we are now, in fact, you know. Castlefield and you know, that road with the free trade all on it and all these venues. I mean, when I go around Manchester and think, I can look at most venues in Manchester and go, rocked it.
You know, I'm boring him. We'll be driving through the city centre. I'm walking with my wife and kids. I'm going, I've DJed there. I've played there.
Yeah, yeah.
I've DJed there.
But that is somehow quite amazing.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
That, you know, it's not that big. You know?
If I was to ask you, Graham, before you go, to describe Manchester in three words, what would they be?
It's capital eccentric. You know, I mean, it lives outside capital thinking. Which allows new thinking, yeah. Which gives invention, and you know, Manchester's just this centre of invention when you go back through history. You know, I know Tony used to bang on about it, you know, and slightly exaggerate things, but you don't have to exaggerate. You know, so much innovation came from this city in terms of broadcasting, in terms of musical output, and yeah. New ideas. You know, computing, you know, a lot of scientific stuff born in this city, you know. I mean, when you go abroad and start, you know, beating your chest about Manchester, you know, somebody has to shut me up about it, you know what I mean? I'm incredibly proud to be from Manchester.
A Mancunian borough. Graham Masty, thank you for being a Human of Excess Manchester.
Thank you for having us.
There you go. That was Graham Masty. Next week, I'm joined by iconic drummer and member of Factory Band, the Deruta Column, Mr. Bruce Mitchell. Don't forget to follow us on social media and subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester. Rate us. Feel free to leave us a review as well. We love getting your feedback. Thanks to our friends at Safer Roads GM once again for sponsoring this series. And thank you for listening. See you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.